blocks away from me. As I walked through the subway, must have been about 3:15. In front of me stood a beautiful honey with a beautiful body. She asked me for the top. I said a customer name, 6-digit number, and a date with me tomorrow at 9. Did she decline? No. Didn't she mind?
I don't think so.
Or was it for real?
Damn sure.
Or what was the deal?
A pretty girl is 24.
So is she cute?
She couldn't wait.
Cinnamon queen.
Let me update.
Or what did she say?
She said she loved to rendezvous. She asked me what we were gonna do. Some stop with a bottle of Moet for two.
Monday. Took her for a drink on Tuesday. We were making love by Wednesday. And on Thursday and Friday and Saturday, we chilled on Sunday. I met this guy on Monday. Took her for a drink on Tuesday. We were making love by Wednesday. And on Thursday and Friday and Saturday, we chilled on Sunday.
Nine was time, cause I began mine, and she was looking fine. Smooth talker, she told me she loved to unfold me all night long. Ooh, I love the way she kicked it, from the front to the back she flipped it. And I hope that you care, cause I'm a man who'll always be there. I'm not a man to play around, baby, cause a one night stand isn't really fair. From the first impression, girl, you don't seem to be like that. Cause there's no need to check, but there'll be plenty of time for that. From the subway to my home, and it's ringing off my phone. When you're feeling all alone, all you gotta do is just call me, call me.
Monday, took her for a drink on Tuesday. We were making love by Wednesday. And on Thursday and Friday and Saturday, we chilled on Sunday. I met this girl on Monday, took her for a drink on Tuesday.
You are tuned to KBOO, Portland.
Tune in to KBOO tonight at 8 o'clock for Squirrel Snow, the one show where we broadcast galactic awareness and animal awareness, where sometimes we have fascinating conversations with experts, authors, activists, and the fields of animal awareness and galactic awareness. And a lot of the time we play amazing music that could effectively raise your frequency of consciousness. Yes, that is Squirrel Snow. Tonight at 8 o'clock here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
News is proud to present our 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, and we want to hear your thoughts as we approach the midterm election. What do you want candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa gift card as a thank you. Plus, it will help our volunteer reporters cover the election with the info that you need to know. Find the survey online at bit.ly/KBOO-survey. That's KBOO's 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, available online through September 25th at bit.ly/KBOO-survey.
Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. Dalal Abu Amni, an acclaimed Palestinian singer who is also a neuroscientist, well known for her classical and folk music performances, as well as her humanitarian and civic activism through her art, is coming to the United States from Palestine to perform in several cities, including San Francisco on September 23rd, Los Angeles on September 25th, Houston on September 30th, and New Jersey on October 2nd. Palestine Foundation is hosting this series of benefit concerts with Dalal and Abu Amni. I have more information on Dalal's tour in the United States on our website, arabvoices.net. The Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies at the University of Houston held its annual AAEF Dr. Burhan and Mrs. Misako Ajouz Professor of Arab Studies Distinguished Lecture in Literature on September 8, 2022, under the title Contemporary Poetry, the Arab American Turn. It was a discussion of Fadi Juda's Tethered to Stars poems and Hayan Sharara's These Trees, Those Leaves, This Flower, That Fruit poems. The discussion was moderated by Dr. Sally Connolly, Associate Professor of English at the University of Houston and Associate Dean of Student and Faculty Success for the College of Liberal Arts and Social Sciences. In this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1027, I will air some of the talk delivered at that event, including the readings of both Fadi Juda and Hayan Sharara, and some of the questions and answers that followed their talk. Let's listen in, and the voice you will hear first is that of Dr. Emiri Jihan Yüksel, Associate Professor at the University of Houston, who is serving as the 2022-23 Acting Director of the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies.
So, good evening. Good evening, and thank you for coming to this special event. So, my name is Emiri Jihan Yüksel, and I'm an Associate Professor of History. And this year, I'm the Acting Director of the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies. So before talking briefly about the center and our activities, I want to acknowledge that I'm actually representing here two prominent colleagues who are not in the room, but I have to acknowledge them, I think. I'm serving as the acting director of the center because the founding director of the center, Dr. Abdelrazzak Takriti, is currently at Brown University for his research and writing sabbatical year. In the meantime, Dr. Hossam Ebulala, who is the main organizer of this lecture, is the chair of Arab American Educational Foundation and Burhan and Mrs. Misako Ajouz Professorship of Arab Studies, is also currently away for his sabbatical at London and with another very prestigious fellowship in his field in literature. So they left me. So we'll see how it goes. So the Center for Arab Studies became active less than 2 years ago and has managed to establish its international reputation as a hub for intellectual exchange, cutting-edge scholarship, commitment to both local and global communities, and the best in creative work, again, locally and globally. In spite of the limitations of lockdown, we have established three recurring annual lectures, celebrated a grand opening attended by local dignitaries and scholars from across the globe, and put together a can't-miss series of online events. The primary driver of the center is Houston's Arab community, who sustains us through energy and financial support. This special relationship allows our center to operate independently to represent our region and its diasporas without external constraints. Special thanks go this evening to the Arab American Educational Foundation and to the Dr. Burhan Ajouz and Mrs. Misako Ajouz Professorship for making this evening possible. Thank you, Dr. Ajouz. Characteristic of the work our center does is sophisticated, specialized interest in multiple aspects of Arab life and culture across the Middle East and among the Arab diaspora. That sophistication is on display this evening as we gather to discuss the most recent poetry of two of the most celebrated U.S. poets of Arab descent, both of whom happen to be members of our community. Fadi Juda is a Palestinian-American physician, poet, and translator, besides being my neighbor. So, Juda's debut collection of poetry, The Earth in the Attic, 2008, won the 2007 Yale Series of Younger Poets competition. Judah followed his second book of poetry, A Light, with text 2, a collection of poems written on a cell phone wherein each piece is exactly 160 characters long. His fourth collection is Footnotes in the Order of Disappearance. Judah's fifth and most recent collection, Tethered to Stars, came out in 2021, was selected as a Library Journal Best Book of Poetry of 2021. So Hayan Sharara is a poet, a children's book author, essayist, and editor. And of course, he's a professor in the Honors College at the University of Houston, so we can say go Cougs. So where he also teaches creative writing, his poetry books are These Trees, These Leaves, This Flower, That Fruit, that came out in 2022, Something Sinister, The Sadness of Others, and The Alchemist's Diary. His children's book, The Three Lucys, received the New Voices Award honor, and he edited Inclined to Speak, an anthology of contemporary Arab American poetry. With Dr. Fadi Judah, he is also a series editor of the Ethel Adnan Poetry Prize. And for this special occasion, Dr. Sally Connolly will be our moderator. So Dr. Sally Connolly is an associate professor of English, again, of one of ours at the University of Houston, and associate dean of student and faculty success for the College of Liberal Arts and Social Sciences. Her first book, Grief and Meter, Elegies for Poets After Odin, was the first ever critical study of the elegies that poets write for each other. Her second book, Wrenches of Isolation, Transatlantic Poetry, considers the sometimes vexed nature of transatlantic poetic relations in a series of wide-ranging essays. She's currently working on a book about the poetry of the AIDS epidemic, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. So, and before leaving the podium to our speakers and presenters, I need to acknowledge, I want to thank to the outstanding work of one of our graduate students, Randel Khalil, and she was somewhere around here. And of course our tireless assistant director, Fadi Kafiti. So, and I'm not sure if Andre is here, but Andre Kapp, who is the business administrator of English department, so he was behind every single decision, I guess. And the Hilton staff in making this event possible. Thank you for all of your hard work. So without further ado, I will leave the podium, the floor to Dr. Connolly.
Hello everyone, good evening. I'm delighted you could join us here for this wonderful event. I'm very excited to get to speak to actual real life poets. One of the things about being a professor of contemporary poetry is that you write away about contemporary poets, and then when you get to meet them, you get to tell them what you think their poetry means. Hopefully they tell you you are absolutely wrong. So I look forward to being corrected repeatedly this evening. So I think what's going to happen is that Fadi and Hayan are going to read a couple of their poems, and then we're going to have an opportunity to discuss them with them. I'm going to let my burning inquisitiveness let me ask them a couple of questions before we open it up to the floor and to hear from you. So who is going to read first? Are we doing it alphabetically?
And first we will listen to Fadi Judah, followed by Hayan Sharara.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. I am going to ask for your attention. I will be reading a somewhat narrative poem, mixed narrative and lyric. It's a little long, might take 9 minutes or so. So put on your concentration hats. The title, The Holy Embraces the Holy, is from a line by the late poet, Jordanian poet Amjad Nasser, who passed away two years ago. And it is from a long poem of his on Petra. And it is one of the most marvelous poems on place I have ever read. So here we go. So it is, Sally and I were talking before, and we were talking about correspondences with other poems. I will not read the numbers of the sections. I will just pause, hopefully. You'll figure out. that you have nothing to say. Your deep sadness reserves me as a den reserves a security blanket. That in the mirror I see you. You were not there. Your silence was a mask. I read from it. The studies done so far have not been good. We agree. More research is needed, more money allocated, so that we practice what we return to when we say, "Don't judge me. I took LSD once." I experienced no visual or auditory hallucinations. The drop possibly had no drop in it. Or maybe the vendor thought to protect my friend, a young medical doctor then, from herself. Or she overpaid. Or the hit was a gift. We went hiking. There was a rattlesnake, and I heard what it had to say. April snow was melting in Zion National Park. We had no wet or dry suits. I saw two currents meet. One held off the other. At the interface, a mirror. God's face in slow-mo plumes of dirt and gravel. Then, in a self-contained area blinded by a bluff, we came across a woman calling out to Bob. He was her husband, she said. She could have been Japanese, had an accent, as I have an accent, with certain names. We offered her a few discerning glances into the woods before my friend whispered one of Zeno's paradoxes to me. Which story do we want to see through on acid? 6 months later, in Paracas, with the same friend, before I became the son of the mother who loved me or loved me not, we visited the national park on the Pacific. The resort was where stone desert is alive with sea and no greenery negotiated life. Mindfully, we went about acquiring more debt. Dinner was included, but we didn't have enough for lunch or breakfast. Complimentary tea or coffee with warm bread and rolls of salted butter was what the queen said we could eat. That was totally unintentional. By the third morning, we went for the gratis like it was a jugular. That your sadness was a silence and your silence no mask. That you have become epic. No chronology sustains you. In Paracas, I shroomed. No hallucination. My grip on reality was wicked. The waves delivered the gust to the shore, and I summoned my magic carpet, straddled it like a bike, my tiptoes on the ground. On the cliffs, a fleet of red condors pulled out their panopticons for the seals 100 meters below. The wind was an exalted rubble off the edge. With their wingspan, some condors rose as if free-falling, then floated above waiting. Condor Legion, the air squadron that bombed Guernica. Historians, when they are camp followers of empire. Poets, when empire's tragic clowns. For dinner, freshly caught large sea bass worthy of display for the dining room guests. We did not tip the waiters. We were not yet the great doctors of America. The driver, we tipped. He played our kind of music on the car radio and took us to a cave where water symbols crashed into stone and nearby fishermen pitched their rods along the shore like streetlights. That you have nothing to say, that your deep sadness is free to be deeply sad near me, some of what love is for. The week before, We'd been on the Inca Trail to Machu Picchu. The stuff about altitude sickness is real, but so is the stuff about cocoa leaves. We ascended into mist, then frigid rain. After long rain, a full moon made love to snow-capped mountains in a cloudless sky. In the sacred city, I wanted to visit the moon temple on Huayna Picchu. Time said I had to take the hill running and hopping at a comfortable non-stop pace so that I might make the last bus down to Aguas Calientes. On my way up, I passed a depleted man sitting on a rock. His half-life was visible in a plastic water bottle. On my descent, he was near the top, a decaying wolf who couldn't blow a house down. I stopped to water time. He gulped, said he was French, asked me where I was from. Did he say French, or did I infer it from the few words he muttered in his deep state of rapid heartbeat and mediocre oxygen exchange? He asked me first. After, I insisted he take an extra gulp from my canteen for heart and lungs to turn serene. I took his question to mean that he wanted to credit my kindness to a place when he gets to tell his story. I gave the credit to Palestine. His face, which had been a theater of struggle, went blank. Suddenly, he was playing poker alone. Did I have a face? Could I have passed for several options? Algerian, Spanish, or could I have been an Afrikaner? Maybe Palestine was the last thing he expected to hear, or his face had nothing to do with the word. Maybe he anticipated American first and foremost because I did say water. Then that in the mirror, I pulled up your hands. A pose you've shadowed all your life isn't always a pose. That your hands were all water, all night. Light was with us, stabbing us in the back. Years passed for years. Into a patient's room, I introduced myself with an apology. For 2 weeks, he'd been a hopeful captive subjected to the merry-go-round of doctors, a dying man with another dead person's heart that gave him all it could. In this world, a person is rarely transplanted more than once. Yes, was the transplanted man's response. You guys are like clowns in a van. Faceless, as in fairness he was to me, I burst out laughing. A few days and he mentioned endings. Said that a chaplain randomly assigned to his floor asked him if he wanted to speak about faith. The chaplain was Muslim, Ali, and the patient was not that kind of Texan. If only more Muslims were this nice, the world would be a better place, the transplanted Lone Star said to me. Leaning against the wall, hands behind my back, I nodded in cold agreement. You're a... he asked. I nodded, yes, neither one of us uttering the word. And you have a sense of humor, too. The other day you laughed at my joke. He loved sailing. That you have nothing to say, from the unrequited to the unconditional to the imaginary. That your sadness unbuttons my heart, needs its clowns. That a heart remains a heart in its beyond. So thanks for, and apologize for any mispronunciations. Raul and Roberto, I was thinking, oh, I screwed up the pronunciations. I like to read this one. It's a short one called Black Hole. The book Tethered to Stars takes the title from, it's a reverses a famous line by Imr al-Qais in one of his, in his Mu'allaqa, where he says that the night is long because the earth is tethered to the stars by linen ropes. And I thought that whether, I was telling Sally, whether the earth spins around the world or the world spins around the earth, we are just the same, tethered to stars. So this one is, there are zodiac titles here and whatnot. This one's called Black Hole. Of impermanence, on whose edges the last escape is infinite. If it is death, this destiny offers me, and in its tail end, a conduit to another realm in which time spins differently than we've known it to pass. A purpose that heaven and hell served for as long as they could before they ran out of gas with no wormhole out of God to show for. An extinguished imagination masquerades as exchangeable commodity. Sometimes a pit grows a supermassive mouth, can swallow its children, but doesn't. And Sally asked me to read this one, so I'll read it. It's a correspondence also. It's a famous echo of Gwendolyn Brooks. So this one's called Neon. It'll be the last one. We rock bottom, we simulacrum, we nothing but air, we divan. We styrofoam, we fashion spume, om and om, we divan. We pyramid eat, we worship sweet, we belly kiss and dimple hips, gin and wine, we divan. Thank you.
Thank you, Fadi. I've read with Fadi so many times. I've lost track how many times, and I know for sure that I've spent more time with this poet than with any other, and I'm grateful for it. I'm glad to be alive and writing at the same time as you. And, you know, I was thinking when Sally's bio was being spoken about elegies for other poets, and I hope I die first and you write one for me. Right? I don't want it to be the other way around. So I'll read a handful of poems, maybe less. This is, I'll start with a short one titled 1979. We were stopped at a red light. I was in the passenger seat, and the guy crossing the street looked at the Buick, then at us, flipped us the middle finger, and said, "Go home, camel jockeys." However hard I try, I can't remember if then and there what the guy said made any difference to me. I was 7. What did I know about crisis? As for the guy, before the light turned green, my father floored the pedal and ran him over. Some more neighbors. This is a poem titled Neighbors, and it's in 4 parts. George killed men in the war. Which men, which war, he doesn't say, and I don't ask. The flowers in his yard, poppies or anemones, remain the most beautiful on the street. The brothers next door celebrate with shots to the moon. Falling rain wets their foreheads, their shingled rooftop, the tall pines rising above the chimney, the soaring tips of their bullets. The chemistry or calculus teacher, Janet or Janice, her dog on my grass. She never picks up after. The one time I said something at the curb, she told me her son, tall and handsome, had turned on himself. She touched her temple, went this way, straight through. The accountant can't get rid of the vine creeping and covering the shrubs alongside his house. After the divorce, he stopped on a bridge, leaned and let the weight slip into a current flowing fast to the Atlantic. So I'll read this poem with gratitude to Fadi, who was, Fadi's usually one of the first and only readers of my poems before I decide that they're finished. I have a couple of other people, but I trust Fadi more than most. And you won't know necessarily, and I don't even remember, but his hands are on this poem here and there. The problem with me is the problem with you. A dog outside barks loudly. Inside, everything quiet. I said I would not, but here I am looking. Dogs snarling and lunging at men naked and hooded. Animals don't know shame, and mine I love, but not so much because love, like oil, spreads thin, clings to the heart, the mind, I don't know. And I suspect when I leave her for days on end, she gets depressed. No woman has ever watched me close the door with such sad eyes. Yes, I've changed the subject. Driving to the airport, I think these days, people long for what is happening to make sense, or to make sense of what is happening. For example, the woman holding the leash is smiling while the man attached to it tries to hide his shame. Sometimes, men want to be like nature, all around, hanging, falling to pieces, the leaves of oak, pine, maple, magnolia, and cypress, too many to count. There will be leaves to bag when I return home, and yes, men in foreign lands will be sent home, and for each his own means of delivery, a seat, a plastic bag. Days like today, times like these, I don't want a damn thing to do with victims. In the terminal, through the windows, the twilight almost imperceptible, evening coming on quickly, and the color of the sky I don't notice. Waiting, I look around. Nothing here compares to anything there. I may look like them, these men who grow old by torture, but I'm not. On the long flight, I take the aisle for comfort and the illusion of safety, and I leave the view to the woman watching beside me, watching me. She looks like someone I would make small talk for, buy a drink. I speak kindly and act like the weather, as much prophecy as science, and like the weather, what makes me frightening, terror in her heart, her mind, is invisible, capable of being identified or anticipated only by those in the know. She has big brown eyes, and I believe that she believes, at my mercy, she will thrive or perish. I reduce myself to cliches. When she says nothing at all, I talk about the weather. I think she's an expert of sorts. Everyone knows something about someone, and the wise interpret for those who cannot read the signs. Turbulence ahead, trouble to come, and on every horizon, a disappearance. So I'm going to read just two more poems, and this one is the longest piece in the new book, and it is, it's called Fugue. I can't read it all. It would take almost 15, 20 minutes, but I'm going to read a handful of excerpts from this, and I'll begin by reading you, I have a few notes in the back of the book, very few, but I have a note for Fugue, and I'll read you two notes for Fugue. I'll read you the notes and then read you a few excerpts. Here's the note. Fugue is comprised of interweaving quotes, at times slightly modified, from the following sources. So these are the works that Fugue comes from. The book, On the Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are, and The Way of Liberation, Essays and Lectures on the Transformation of the Self, both by Alan Watts. Don't Ask, a collection of interviews with Philip Levine, the poet, and Sven Lindqvist's A History of Bombing. Fugue also contains a single excerpt from What Every Person Should Know About War by Chris Hedges. The word fugue has two distinct senses, the first grounded in music, the second in psychiatry. Here's the first definition. Fugue is a polyphonic composition constructed of one or more short subjects or themes, which are harmonized according to the laws of counterpoint and introduced from time to time with various contrapuntal devices. The second definition, a fugue, a flight from one's own identity, often involving travel to some unconsciously desired locality. Life is a game, the first rule of which is that this is not a game, it's deadly serious. Nothing more obvious than what our politicians do to our language. So if we insist on the truth, on an accurate rendition, a faithful use of language, if we insist on an accurate depiction of people's lives as they actually live them, this becomes a political act. When we played, it was always war. In our hands, any old stick was a weapon. Pine cones were bombs. If everyone plays war, said my mother, there will be war. She was right, there was. True creation is always purposeless, without ulterior motive. Your whole notion of reality is just a lie. Your country isn't what you had been told it was. The others aren't what you'd been told they were. Nobody is what you'd been told they were. The past is utter horseshit. In the beginning was the bomb. If you look at Jan van Eyck's painting of the Last Judgment, everybody in heaven is completely bored, sitting there looking like the cat that swallowed the canary. Rows and rows of them with the Lord God Almighty presiding and looking equally bored. All those stately people in heaven are destined to stay in church forever in an obvious state of ultimate boredom. But down below there is a bat-winged skull spreading out its ghastly wings, and all nude bodies writhing, being eaten by snakes in each other. An orgy. We have never admitted that our idea of heaven is a perfectly useless state. The other day I was sitting on the train with a young woman and she began talking about mime, about these problems she would work on, all very vague at first. So I said, what the hell is a real problem? Tell me. She said, looking in someone's eyes. It was startling. So much of being a poet is looking other people in the eyes, looking yourself in the eyes, accepting vulnerability. It's better that women and children die than they become hysterical and create panic. Bang, you're dead. It's for the best. The ego sees, hears sounds. The ego sees sights, hears sounds, feels feelings, and has experiences. These are common but redundant ways of talking, for seeing a sight is just seeing. Hearing a sound is just hearing. Feeling a feeling is just feeling, and having experience is just experiencing. But that these redundant phrases are so commonly used shows that most people think of themselves as separate from their thoughts and experiences. You said John Berryman taught you a lot about poetry and its importance. How did he think poetry was important? He was able to pick up the newspaper full of Eisenhower, John Foster Dulles, Joe McCarthy and the various American idiots of our time, and he'd say, kids, this will pass. These idiots will be replaced by other idiots. Don't worry about it. Then he'd put alongside that paper the poems of John Keats and say, this will not pass as long as our language is spoken. Some things are transient, and some things come close to being permanent. Don't lose sight of that. And yet, from the beginning, genocide is inscribed in our earliest and holiest texts, the Old Testament, the Iliad, the Aeneid. These are your instructions. The startling truth is that our best efforts for civil rights, international peace, population control, conservation of natural resources, and assistance to the starving of the earth, urgent as they are, will destroy rather than help if made in the present spirit. For as things stand, we have nothing to give. If our own riches and our own way of life are not enjoyed here, they will not be enjoyed elsewhere. Peace can be made only by those who are peaceful. Love can be shown only by those who love. No work of love will flourish out of guilt, fear, or hollowness of heart, just as no valid plans for the future can be made by those who have no capacity for living now. Good poems demand to be written from inside the poet. What happens with most political poems is that poets in certain situations think a poem is needed and they are obliged to sit down and write it, producing crap. One very important way in which men can attain joy, freedom, happiness, even delirium and ecstasy is by not staying home with wife and family, even to the point where often enough they are only too happy to give up their nearest and dearest in favor of war. To paraphrase the gospel, love your competitors and pray for those who undercut your prices. The political and personal morality of the West, especially in the United States, is, for lack of this sense, utterly schizophrenic. It is a monstrous combination of uncompromising idealism and unscrupulous gangsterism, and thus devoid of the humor and humanness which enables confessed rascals to sit down together and work out reasonable deals. No one can be moral. No one can harmonize contained conflicts without coming to a working arrangement between his rose above and his manure below. One of the most attractive qualities about a poem is its ambition. Bang, you're dead, we said. Now you're dead, we said. I'm gonna leave you with one more poem. I know I went longer than Mr. Modesty here. I have a number of self-portraits in the book, and this is one of them. This poem was accepted, I like to tell this story, and apologies if you feel the same way that the Poetry Foundation felt. It was accepted by the guest editor, Fatima Ashkar, who's a poet, and then she wrote back and said, we can't use it because the Academy said it's obscene. And I know there's maybe more than one way to understand obscene, but I always understood obscene in its sort of a classical sense, and that is that something that, you know, arouses sexual curiosities. There's just no way that this poem does that. So I think they just meant profane, not obscene. But they didn't take it. But they said we can't publish it. And I understand. I think this is the Poem a Day series, and it goes to schools and, you know, I don't know. Whatever, my kids have heard this before and they're fine. Anyway, another journal took it. Ironically, the oldest journal in the United States published it. Self-portrait with curses at 35,000 feet. On a flight to Detroit, the guy next to me told me about his job, his dumb slobbering dog, his good-for-nothing kids, two of them, and his lying, cheating wife. Moving at 500 miles per hour above the earth without feeling it, I listened to him go on and on, his pain from bad to worse. To what wisdom does suffering give birth? And must we always learn from it? Earlier that morning, my mother had died, and going back to her once and for all, I would find out. But first, I had to suffer Bob. Bob. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was wonderful.
You're listening to Arab Voices coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. What you just heard were readings of Fadi Juda's Tethered to Stars poems and Hayan Sharara's These Trees, Those Leaves, This Flower, That Fruit poems. They were speaking at the annual Arab American Educational Foundation Dr. Burhan and Mrs. Misako Ajouz, Professor of Arab Studies Distinguished Lecture in Literature, held on September 8, 2022, under the title Contemporary Poetry, the Arab American Turn. The event was organized by the Arab American Educational Foundation Center for Arab Studies at the University of Houston. There was a question and answer session that followed their talk. Let's listen to some of those questions from the audience and the answers to them by Fadi Juda and Hayan Sharara.
Soren Kierkegaard, he said in his book, The Lily of the Field and the Bird of the Air, he discusses this idea of, are poets heroes? That made me think. And I asked a Persian poet this question. And he said to me, for us in our tradition, the question is not, are poets heroes? Our poets are the heroes. So I'm wondering, from an Arab perspective, would you say the same, or do you have a different approach to that?
Again, people will read Kierkegaard and they won't read I have written in 100 years. That's generous. But I do think that he was also trapped in his particularity of time. I am not entirely sure that we live a moment where poets are heroes. I'm not sure what the definition of a hero is. I think that, poets are many things. They cannot be just one thing. And they are sometimes great translators of the language that a collective heart speaks. Whether somebody decides that that's heroic or not, I don't know. I think there's a conservatism in referring to poets as heroes that relates to millennia or long tradition in human history, that all sorts of poets are heroes in various definitions of the word. Maybe a mystic is a hero, but so I don't know what exactly we mean by hero, and I don't know what we can talk later what Kierkegaard what conclusion he reached in that book that I have not read, just to spite him because he's more famous than I am. But I do think that we ask these questions in the 20th, 19th, 21st century, whatever, based on a civilizational construct of the nation state. And they are incredibly political questions, and they don't need to be, in my opinion. A poet is a poet is a poet. I may not be a hero, but if I am your hero, I mean, who am I? You know, God help you, but who am I to who am I to tell you I am not? You know? But I think that we are quite taken by these kind of large constructs that, especially like, you know, for someone like me in English, how can it not be an imposed political question on me as a Palestinian writing in English or even speaking in English? Which American hero, which American poet considers themselves a hero? I'm saying, you know, but it's interesting that the question now is asked of those who are not American. Yeah. Is my answer.
Well, that wasn't my aim. It was just a curiosity.
Yeah, yeah,
it was
yeah.
Something I had to wonder as well. Like, yeah. Do I see poets as heroes?
I'll answer it slightly differently. And so I teach a course in which we do great books, and Kierkegaard would be one. But we're reading right now Homer's Iliad, and the hero, as defined by Homer's era, is the person who's most excellent at killing other people. Is the person who is most willing to die for honor and glory, And those, I mean, my students often have such a difficult time understanding why these people are placed not only on pedestals, but talked about as if they were gods. So the definition of the hero today is obviously very different. And it depends on, say, who you're asking and where you're coming from. As far as American poets go, whatever the American sensibility has decided a hero is, largely speaking, generally speaking, I don't think poets are a part of that. I mean, we are just not there. We are not on a pedestal. I don't think we're in the same stadium as the American heroic character is. For better or worse, perhaps, I don't know.
Who is the poet that you think had the most influence on each of you? I mean, the one you admire the most and you think that has influence on you.
It's really hard to think of just one name. I used to, and you know, please do not let the religious police know, but I used to read the Quran a lot, and when I was younger, during Ramadan. And to me, and to this day, I return to my memories of the language of that book, because there are so many qualities of being in that text that open up the mind to the lyric and the poetic in ways that I only understood when I stopped reading the Quran and I came to the States and I became a doctor and so forth. I
know you want a name. I'll give you a name, so I'll scratch that itch. But the
music in the mind is what poetry is to me. I was a child who my father or uncle would ask me to memorize certain poems, and I realized at a young age that this made me so happy. And so I was always, and I still am, in search of a music that brings me that kind of serenity and, you know, euphoria that I did or experienced as a child. So as with names, the idea of the serenity and the euphoric, they change with time as we change. It's the same thing with the heroic question. You ask one question and you say, you know, which one influenced you the most? And I know you may not mean it this way, but it suggests a closure, as if somehow like the whole thing ended and then it was all me after that. And you know, there's always a continuation. The poets I read now in Arabic or in English are not poets I read when I was younger. And thank God I found them late, because I'm so tired of the old ones. Obviously, everybody probably in the Arab world, whether they liked it or not, or liked him or not, grew up with Darwish. And you know, in English, it's fascinating to me that my first attraction was to someone like Rilke. Time moves on.
I know the Queen died today of England, and she was not a poet as far as I know, but you know, I'm sure there were people who were saddened by it. Sally is someone, and this is where she comes from, and you know, I asked her about it, and she said she shed a tear for her. I responded the same way some years ago on February 14th when Philip Levine died. If you don't know who Philip Levine is, I urge you to look up his poems. And I was a third-year student at Wayne State University, ready to take my MCATs to maybe consider medical school, and I found a book of Philip Levine's poems, and I sat in the bookstore for about an hour or so reading them, and I broke my parents' heart within a week when I told them I don't want to be a doctor anymore. I'm going to be a poet. You can imagine how they responded to a 19-year-old saying that he was going to become a poet. Even though my mother was a teacher of literature, my father and grandfather could recite thousands of poems, but they wanted a doctor.
So. Thank you for both being here, and my question would be in this territory of nomadic poets. Both of you are Arab Americans, and I'm sure your poetry in English dialogue a lot with poetry in Arabic. And as you mentioned earlier, the idea of diagnosis, or poetess diagnostician, more or less. Since Rubén Darío stamped modernity or modern poetry with the equation of from symbolism to reality, in the Arabic poetry we have this stamp in different equation, probably from reality to symbolism. And both of you touch base a little bit with some politics, although you try to distance yourself a lot from this idea of victim aesthetics, which is great. And my question to you is the following: how American reader or the Anglophone reader, including the codified one, come about this idea of dialogue, of dialogism between two registers of poetry, the Arabic one and the English one?
That is the sage on this one, really. You are. I mean, your thinking that you've been doing for quite a while now about, Palestine and English and Palestine and Arabic, I think is important and answers this in a way that's new for most people. I think you should talk about it.
I think I already feel like I'm going to disappoint you. But I'm already.
It wouldn't be the first time. It's okay.
I was gonna say I'm already married, so hey. I think that if I want to be blunt and simple and brief, that I do not think that readers on the whole of American poetry or Anglophone poetry of writers who write in this double register, as it relates to Arabic, have an idea where to begin. And so it reduces us to explaining ourselves like a comedian who tells jokes and then has to explain them. And so the conversation for me is about leaving a record that honors my belief in the art of poetry for a future time. Because I do think that it will open. You require, it's really interesting, for example, to me, and I'll try to articulate this, that we live in an age with this nation-state business where there is a nation of the exiled poets, which is, in a way, did not exist in the same propensity volume in previous eras. You'll say, "Oh, but of course, so and so was, and so and so was." But we are still trying to understand to come to grips to these poets who exist in this kind of double register, especially if the double register is not one that is assimilated yet. We only understand the double register when it is assimilated, and we at best work hard to assimilate it. And it does not mean that the work I do will be assimilated, at least not in my lifetime. So, so for me, it's a conversation with human language. And look, I want to tell you this story. In the Modern Language Association, I was invited to be on a panel to speak about the embargo, continued embargo on Palestinian literature. The Modern Language Association, this was a few years ago, was trying to rally its members to vote for the BDS, the boycott divestment and sanctions against Israel. And so I was speaking with others, and a person in the audience at the end asked me this question. And this is a professor, and I understood later that he was asking the question because, a professor of literature, because he wanted to make sure that nobody misunderstood anything and that I am, you know, a safe dog to pet. The question was, do you believe that Hebrew is capable of love the same way as Arabic? And my answer, I was like, who isn't capable of, like, what are you talking, like, which language would know more or less about love than another language? So you're asking me in this society to have an open conversation about what it means to be a beautiful Arab writing in English? I don't think so. But I will be beautiful and I'll continue to write.